Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Here on Radio EcoShock, you've heard speakers like Dr. Daniel Pauly lament that humans are stripping the oceans bare of species. I've played you a clip of Dr. Wes Jackson on the possibility of a mass extinction event in the seas, and paleoclimatologist Peter Ward told us up to 90% of ocean life has been killed off in a big extinction event that happened many millions of years ago. These things can happen, so I took this all in mind when I got a new book from Peter F. Sale. He works with the United Nations University, and he is a professor emeritus at the University of Windsor, Ontario. Peter Sale, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
I'm glad to be there, Alex.
Peter, the title of your book, it turned me off at first. It's called Our Dying Planet, An Ecologist's View of the Crisis We Face. Sometimes I'm called extreme. Why would you say the planet is dying?
Obviously, we're not talking about the planet dying. The planet isn't alive. But what we are talking about is the most serious environmental crisis we've faced since the Pleistocene.
I'd say you were exaggerating, but a new study published in the journal Nature found 75% of all mammal species on the land are at risk of extinction within 300 years.
One of the reasons I wrote the book was I was more and more alarmed at what I was seeing in my own studies of coral reefs and in what I was reading from other areas of environmental science. And I was concerned that the majority of people had very little appreciation of just how serious a problem we're creating for ourselves. And I thought, well, what can I do? I'm a teacher. Maybe I can provide something that will educate people.
Well, let's back up a little bit and retrace your own steps in science. You have a lot of expertise in coral reefs, and I found your description of what coral is, how it works, really kept me interested. Talk to us for a minute about the wonders of coral.
A coral reef only exists under quite narrow environmental conditions. They don't occur outside the tropics because reef-building corals cannot tolerate cold water. They don't occur in deep water because they've got to be shallow enough because the corals have a symbiotic alga that lives within their tissues. And these algae have got to be able to do photosynthesis, which means they need light, so the reef has to be close to the surface. They've got to have high-quality water, unpolluted, or the corals die. So there's really narrow requirements, and you only find them in some places. So when you see a reef, you're seeing a fortunate set of events that have happened. Coral reefs have been with us since the Ordovician, about 425 million years ago. There's been several times in the past where there have been no reefs for 20 million years or so, when conditions weren't right, but the corals have managed to persist in tiny little populations that got through those 20 million year gaps. And when the conditions are right, we get this flowering of the most diverse marine community on Earth, and in some ways the most diverse ecosystem on Earth. Rainforest trump reefs in terms of how many species they have in them, because rainforests have an inordinate number of insects. But coral reefs are more diverse than rainforests if you look at, for example, how many phyla of organisms they have, how many families or orders of organisms they have. It is a much broader diversity than the diversity of the rainforest. Or to give you a number, 25% of marine species live on coral reefs. Now, not all of those 25% are restricted to coral reefs, and if coral reefs disappear, some of those 25% will still be around. But we're talking about a quarter of all the organisms that live in the ocean are associated with coral reefs. So they are absolutely wonderful. Unfortunately, we have been hammering away at them in various ways, and now with climate change, we're doing things to them which are literally going to lead to another one of these long gaps of tens of thousands of millions of years without reefs, unless we change what we're doing to the climate.
Right, so this living treasure is possibly starting to die off. Tell us about mass bleaching events.
Okay. Before I do that, let me just comment on the term living treasure. It's a treasure biologically, it is also a treasure to the countries that have them along their shores. These are extremely valuable ecosystems. The Great Barrier Reef is valued as worth several billion dollars a year to the Australian economy, primarily through tourism, but also through fisheries. If you go to the Caribbean, most of the Caribbean basin countries get 50% or more of their GDP from their coastal activities, and these are tourism and fishing. And while many of the tourists don't actually go and look at the reef, they just sit on the beach is produced by sand, which comes from the reef. So these reefs are tremendously valuable economically. They also do a lot of coastal protection, which doesn't even factor in when you talk about GDP. Coral bleaching. I've got a picture of coral bleaching on the front of the book. Looks beautiful. Beautiful white coral, as far as the eye can see. And what has happened is the corals have been stressed by high temperatures. Because they're stressed, they have evicted their algal symbiotic cells, and the algae are what have the color. So the algae leave, and you're left with this translucent coral, and what you're looking at is the white skeleton shining through the translucent tissues of the coral. As I say, it can look beautiful to the uninformed, but it's beautiful deaf, because if the stressed conditions last for 3 weeks or so, the corals die. And the first recorded what we call mass bleaching, where lots and lots of coral was bleached, was in 1983. We're pretty sure it had never happened before that in human history. It has happened frequently since that, such that the estimates are that about 20% of the living coral in the world has been killed off already by coral bleaching.
So do we think that bleaching is related to climate change?
It's definitely related to climate change. What is happening is the climate change is causing an increase in sea surface temperatures. And obviously, there are seasonal fluctuations in temperatures, and there are things such as the El Nino events where you get warmer than usual sea surface temperatures in particular periods during an El Nino. And basically, what happens is the corals are living very close to the maximum temperatures they can tolerate in the summertime. If you get an El Nino in the summertime, they get extra hot. With climate change, they're now getting sufficiently hot that they're getting stressed, they're getting bleached, and they're dying.
One of the things I think you really draw out well in your book, and building on this coral theme idea, is that it isn't just one cause. It isn't just climate change. You've got all the pollution that's happening, the damage to the reefs from tourism. There's a lot of things that humans do that damage the environment. Do you find that that's one of the difficulties, is trying to get people to accept complex reasons why things happen as opposed to one single thing?
Yes, I agree with you completely, and that is another reason why I wrote the book. One of the points I wanted to make in writing this book was that we have one big, complicated problem, not a series of separate problems. It's too easy to stand them up separately, and then you can get people arguing as to whether we should be dealing with climate change or pollution or overfishing or deforestation or invading species. We need to stop, step back, and say, hey, these are all related. They're all part of the same thing. You can't deal with one without dealing with the others. And I think if people knew how serious it was, they would be a lot more motivated than they are to try and do something about it.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with author and educator Peter F. Sale. His new book is Our Dying Planet, An Ecologist's View of the Crisis We Face. I mentioned Dr. Daniel Pauly in the introduction. He's now at the University of British Columbia. He talks about something called the shifting baseline syndrome. Could you talk to us about that?
Yes, and I'm delighted you mentioned Daniel Pauly, because I remember meeting him years ago in Australia at a meeting when he and I were both a lot younger. And he was a dynamic and interesting scientist then, and he still is. And he's been one of those people who has been diligently putting the information out there, telling people what we're doing to the ocean. His concept of the shifting baseline, I've got a chapter on it in the book. We don't notice change when it happens slowly. He called it the shifting baseline. You have a baseline of what you think things used to be like, and then you look at how they are now. But the baseline keeps shifting each generation because people only look back to a few years ago. They don't look back hundreds of years ago. Because we don't notice it, we're not aware of it. Because we're not aware of it, we're not concerned about it. Most people you talk to, most Canadians you talk to, if you say something about climate change, they say, oh, yes, but it's only going to warm up a couple of degrees. But that is immense, and it's having immense consequences to many aspects of our weather, our hydrological system, the availability of water in our ecosystem. All of these things are being changed by those tiny little changes in climate, and the problem is those changes are progressive.
Now, another barrier to our understanding this ecological crisis is the way our brains work. Most of us, and I have to admit, sometimes me, we have trouble comprehending what you call exponential change. Could you give us an example, maybe, or help us through that one?
Well, the example I love is the apocryphal story of the young man who's traveling and comes across a damsel in distress and rescues her from the dragon and discovers she's the princess, and the king wants to reward him. And the young man says, as a reward, he would like one grain of wheat on the first square of his chessboard, then two grains on the second square, and four grains on the third square, and eight grains on the fourth square. And the king says, no, 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 I want to give you something really significant. The young man holds his ground, and of course the king agrees to do this. He empties his granary, he empties his treasury, buying grain from his neighbors. The fact is the king goes completely bankrupt producing the amount of grain which the young man was asking for. Exponential change is what that story talks about, something which increases at an increasing rate. And there's lots of examples of exponential change in the world. One of the best is the change growth of the human population, which until quite recently was exponentially increasing. Thankfully, it's now slowing down a little bit, but it is still increasing dangerously. And we do not understand these kinds of rapid change in numbers or amounts or any of the other things. And because we don't understand them and don't appreciate them, we get into trouble. We get into trouble with exponential change in managing our credit card debt because the interest applies onto the interest and it exponentially increases, and suddenly you discover you can't pay off your credit card because you let it build up too high. That's exponential change. It's very painful when it runs away like that. And we've got examples of that in our environmental crisis.
Including, I believe, the rate at which carbon dioxide is going into the atmosphere. It's increasing a little bit every year, so that it's growing, not just because a year went by, but because it's actually growing in the rate that we're emitting.
Yeah, it's not growing exponentially, if one wants to be mathematically, technically accurate, but it is growing at an increasing rate. So the line is not straight up. It's not a straight line increasing the same amount each year. It's a little bit more each year. And incidentally, the business about climate change and evidence for it, you can go on the web anytime to the NOAA site and see the data on the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere over Mauna Loa. The data are right there. You see the graph increasing upwards. It's almost a 390, it's just over 390 parts per million now. People who say, oh, I don't believe in it, those people mostly are people who simply decided this is something they don't want to believe in. It's a little unpleasant, so I'll build a little wall around it, and then I'll go on with my life with that little bit of my memory walled off, and I won't think about it. But the evidence is all around us, and the data are all around us. The data are remarkably publicly available.
Well, Peter, we don't have to worry about it because the balance of nature will always come back. Nature's pretty self-regulating. She should take care of this situation just the way we were taught in school.
Yeah, I wish it were true. This is another one of the things that I try and talk about as clearly as possible in the book. We have an amazing faith in the capacity of the natural world to deal with the things we do to it and recover from them. And the fact of the matter is the natural world is far less in balance than we think it is. There are far fewer things out there that will make it repair itself. And we should have known this a long time ago. We have repeatedly overfished particular populations of fish and watched them collapse, and they never come back or very rarely come back. You know, I talk about the Atlantic cod in the book. The Atlantic cod sustained a vigorous fishery, a tremendously valuable fishery, for about 500 years. But we finally finished them off. And yes, there are still cod out there, and there's still hopeful fishermen and hopeful government scientists, and maybe they will come back, because sometimes it happens. But there's nothing pushing them back. There's no law that says if you stop fishing, it will rebound instantly to where it was. Our faith in the balance of nature is totally unrealistic and unjustified.
Well, Peter, although you cover some solutions in a later chapter, you do have a haunting description of how a continuing loss of species could play out. Humans may not recognize the loss until it's way too late. Can you tell us just a little bit about what that experience would be like?
At the present time, we are in the middle, or in the early stages, perhaps, of what people are now calling the Holocene mass extinction. There have been five mass extinctions in the past, and the biggest was the end of the Permian, when 90% of species went extinct. If it had been 100%, we wouldn't be here talking about it, and there would never have been any dinosaurs. The experiment with life would have been over. Fortunately, it was only 90%. But believe me, if you take away 90% of species, you substantially change the ecology, and you substantially alter what's going to happen next. We are in the middle of the most rapid increase in the rate of extinction that has occurred in geological history. It is caused by us. We started out in the Pleistocene when we learned how to hunt in groups. We became quite good at finishing off large mammals. We have gone on and finished off lots of fish species and lots of other animals by overhunting them. We now typically cause extinctions of species by altering their habitat so they cannot survive, or taking over their habitat and changing it totally into something else. So we're very good at causing the extinction of species. People such as Edward Wilson at Harvard University and a number of others have looked at this in detail. They've looked at the rates at which species are disappearing, and they're making predictions like 50% or more of all species on Earth gone by 2100. That is enormous, and that doesn't say the process stops at 2100, because if we keep going the way we're going, we'll still be causing extinction. What you have to do is imagine a forest with hardly any kinds of trees left, or imagine a forest with no kinds of trees left. If you don't have any tree species, you don't have a forest anymore, and if you don't have a forest, there's lots of other things that disappear. And I believe the extent of the biodiversity loss, which is what this is so great that we should be really very concerned about it, because we need these things. These creatures out there, these plant species and these animal species and even the microbes, we need them. They provide our food. They provide our environment. They provide the oxygen in the air we breathe. They provide what we use for our lives, and we're part of it. We can't survive without the rest of it. And I think the loss of species that is predicted is so extreme that we would be foolish to assume that somehow none of the species that really matter to us will get lost. They will. And then what do we do? Because we don't yet know how to create life.
If you are just tuning in, our guest on Radio EcoShock is author and ecologist Peter F. Sale. In your book, Our Dying Planet, you suggest there are four possible paths for our civilization now. I'd like to take just a few minutes to talk about them. Let's start with that Belvedere world. Why call it that, and what does it look like?
I called it Belvedere because Belvedere sounds luxurious and comfortable, and that is exactly what the world looks like to those people on the inside. And basically, the Belvedere world is the one we're headed towards on a 8-lane superhighway as fast as we can get there. It is a world of gated communities, fortress communities, armored communities, living in luxury inside their walls, protected from the nasty environment outside. And then between these gated communities, there's kind of a Mad Max sort of a world of people living in horrible conditions with famine and starvation and war and disease and all the other bad things you don't want to think about. This, I fear, is the world we're going to go towards as the rich countries initially make sure they have what they want, to hell with the rest, and then as things deteriorate even further, it will become the rich communities within the rich countries that become the gated communities. And some people will live for several generations in quite wonderful surroundings, but ultimately they will either be vanquished by the desperate hordes or they will die of diseases which get in through all kinds of fortification. And I don't see it as a good solution. It's not the solution I would want to see. But that's the most likely one we're headed towards. And all of our current behavior in the developed countries suggests that's the world we're going towards.
That's the me first world. Well,
the me first world.
Yeah. Well, you have a second scenario that sounds more friendly, at least for me. You call it the Woodstock future. What do you mean there?
The Woodstock future is the one that you hear typically put forward by people who want to argue against changing our energy strategies. The people who want to argue that there's no way we can have an advanced civilization and have carbon-free fuels. The Woodstock world is a world of people living in very basic surroundings with minimal enterprise, minimal energy sources, a sort of a fondly hippie-esque movement where you go back to basics and you don't have international trade and you do not have all the things that we now think of as making up our advanced civilization. You give up the things that take energy as a way of stopping using energy. You go back to an agrarian society. It becomes a much simpler society. It could be a very attractive society in some ways, but I don't think it's a society we're going to choose to get to because people don't want to give things up. So it's a society that I don't actually see it as coming. It is possible, but I don't see it as coming because most people won't want to have it. And if people don't want to have it, it's not going to happen.
And you contrast that with your third possible future called Technopolis, and I guess that's self-explanatory, or is it?
I think it is. Technopolis is the future, and there are people out there right now who are solving, in their own minds, solving the climate change problem by building elaborate sunscreens that will be floated up in space, or they're going to pump sulfur dioxide up into the atmosphere to counteract the intensity of the sunlight and reflect the light away so we don't heat up so much. I mean, it's a technical solution to everything. This is the future where science and engineering solve all problems without any difficulty at all. We just invent our way out of the mess we're making. I think the Technopolis future has one absolutely huge flaw, and the flaw is that we only have one planet to live on, and if we make a mistake, we have screwed ourselves. I don't believe that any technical advance has ever gone forward without mistakes being made, and I don't think we have the luxury of making mistakes. It is a commonly held belief by those people who genuinely believe that we do not need the natural world. We can do without it. We'll simply invent replacements for the things the natural world provides for us. There are people who will try and move in that direction, and I think it'll be a failure. And when I say a failure, I mean a failure with a collapse of civilization. I think it would happen.
But you do see a fourth alternative pathway. What is that?
And my fourth alternative I call New Atlantis. This is obviously the one that I favor. This is a world where we have advanced civilization. We have all the toys and the inventions which we love. We have an intellectually vibrant civilization. We have culture and the arts and the sciences and all these things going on. But we are living in a world which is sustainably managed, a world which continues to provide the environmental goods and services that our lives depend upon. This is a world which is reachable, but it is a much more difficult one to reach than Belvedere, because it's going to require that we make some quite difficult changes quite soon. We have got to look at how we use fuel, and we have got to use different fuels. We have got to find ways of being much more efficient in our use of energy so that we do not waste it and pollute in the process. We have got to look at our overuse of natural resources, the renewable resources, like the resources provided from our farms, from forests, from fisheries, making sure that we are using those at a rate which is sustainably replaceable year after year. And I think inevitably in this world we have got to look at a human population which is not growing, and preferably a human population which is smaller than the one we currently have.
As we finish off, is there anything else you'd like to add for our listeners?
The most important thing I would like to say is don't get depressed by this kind of news. There's no point in sitting around being depressed. Become active. Talk to people about it. Talk to them about the fact that you can't simply put environmental problems on one side while you deal with other things.
This is Radio EcoShock. We've been talking with Peter F. Sale. He's currently involved with United Nations University, and he's a professor emeritus at the University of Windsor. Peter knows the sea and its creatures, and that comes out in his new book, provocatively titled Our Dying Planet, from the University of California Press. Peter, thank you so much for joining us.
It was wonderful to talk to you, Alex.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. Get all our previous programs at our website, ecoshock.org. We'll go out with Talking Drums by Ariel Kalma.